to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Well, we're going to be talking about a couple of really interesting topics on the show. Honey and beekeeping starts, and then we'll switch to winemaking and wine. So honey and wine today, and we've got a couple of guests to start talking about beekeeping and honey. One of them, Drew Kaiser, is a partner in Kaiserson Bee Company of Eau Claire. Drew's been a prominent advocate for beekeeping in western Wisconsin for more than a decade, I believe, particularly urban beekeeping. And last year, his company had 65 colonies in 15 locations. Drew Kaiser, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining in today.
It's great to be here, Larry. Thanks for having me.
With us as well, Emily Cedo is the 2025 Wisconsin Honey Queen. She's also studying ag and applied economics and public policy at UW-Madison. Emily, great to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, really great to have you in the studio. Give us a question. Give us a call with your questions. Maybe you've got a question about making honey. Maybe you want to start your own beehive. Whether you live in the city or country, I believe you can do it in most cases. And I hope you'll share your experiences, or maybe you don't have any experience, you just have questions. Well, we'll love those as well. Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Emily, you're the 2025 Wisconsin Honey Queen. What does that title entail?
So as the 2025 Wisconsin Honey Queen, I get to travel all across Wisconsin and serve as a promoter for the honey industry and its products, along with being an educator, being able to do presentations to civics groups, or just kind of being out and about at expos.
So what kinds of demonstrations do you do?
So actually, at the Wisconsin State Fair, I will be there all of the days, and I do cooking demonstrations on the main stage. So doing things with honey and just kind of showing some really cool recipes.
How did you get involved in this in the first place? Do you have a background in, I don't believe you do have your own hive or anything.
So I don't have my own hive, but I grew up very immersed in agriculture from a young age with goats and horses. And then on our separate family farm, we do lots of crops. So we'd always ask beekeepers to keep their bees on our land as it really helps with our yields. And it also helps get some pretty cool honey varieties.
Yeah, I bet. And that brings me to Drew. Drew Kaiser, tell us a bit about what you do at Kaiserson Bee Company.
Yeah. Well, as you alluded to, I've been at it for over a decade. I think this is going to be my 15th season keeping bees. And we do things a little bit differently than most beekeepers. We really emphasize urban beekeeping as well as some rural beekeeping. So we started, my wife and I, when I say we, Kaiserson is myself and Ellen Sorensen, so hence Kaiserson. And we place small numbers of colonies around the Chippewa Valley and pull little bits of honey off of them as the bees allow us to, and jar them by their individual location and dates, which is really kind of an interesting exercise because we're able to lock in very different nectar flows from different plants, which gives us anything from almost water white, crystal clear honey to jet black honey and in between. And so we like sharing the flavors and the story about what the bees do with all the people that will listen.
And you have some new infused products as well?
Yeah. We've been working with the state of Wisconsin and just received our food processing license from DATCAP. And so within the last couple of days, we've actually just launched a hot honey line. And we're doing a lavender infused line initially as well, looking to increase that in the coming weeks and months with things like tea-infused line. So we're working with Tony over at Sacred Blossom Farm in Mondovi to identify different herbs that he thinks are going to work well with the honey profiles we have. And we're really all about collaboration. So we've worked with distilleries and breweries. We've worked with bakers. We love to work with farmers. And we like to explore the difference that we can get from honey and the different ways to use it.
I have some very good friends who own Gentle Breeze Honey in Mount Horeb, and they produce a hot honey. How hot is hot? I mean, I love their hot honey. It's a different kind of a.
You know, we're in the Midwest, so we try not to scorch people's faces off. Our initial product is definitely much more of a glimmer of chili flavor. So we do a mixture of honey, various different chilies, a little bit of cinnamon, and then a touch of vinegar. So it's really a nice condiment to be able to use on savory foods. We like the contrast. Yeah.
Sounds really good. Emily, do you ever use hot honey in any of your demonstrations?
I have not, but I was just recently introduced to it back in February. It was a peach habanero mix. It was pretty solid.
you like, was it hot, really hot, or was it?
You know, the initial, it was very nice. And then after it sat for about 5 minutes, it started to kick in a little bit more.
There's a little bit of an afterburn there.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, man. Talking honey with Emily Cito, who's our Wisconsin honey queen, and Drew Kaiser, partner in Kaiser's and Bee Company in Eau Claire. And you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Emily, how popular is beekeeping in Wisconsin? You probably have some facts and figures running around your head.
Just a little bit. Wisconsin ranks 11th in beekeeping. So in past years, we've been in top 10. And mm-hmm. So we just tend to fluctuate. And in Wisconsin, we can produce around 3 million pounds each year. But not every beekeeper does submit their data into the survey and stuff like that. So again, beekeeping does fluctuate year to year.
And back to you, Drew. How much honey do you produce each year?
Well, we're pretty small potatoes compared to some of the agriculture, the larger beekeepers. I think last year was about 2 tons, so about 4,000 pounds of honey.
A lot of honey. It's a lot of honey. Nina in Abbotsford has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Nina.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I know there are bird baths, and then I've been reading about places for bees to drink water and how to go about that. And maybe then not to attract the wasps and the hornets.
Well, probably if you're going to get one, you're going to get the other, Drew. I don't know. What do you think?
To some extent, I think that you're likely to see bees a little bit more than wasps and hornets. Their honeybee colonies tend to be significantly larger than some of those other stinging cousins may be. In terms of the how, the big thing is about creating a situation in which they can land. And so they really love mud. If you look at creek beds and the shores around them, that's a common place for a lot of our insect pollinators to be able to go and drink from. So you mentioned a bird bath. A really great way to adapt a bird bath is to add some stones or some marbles or just a few hard objects kind of in the middle of it to allow for bees to land and take a drink and be able to fly back off of that.
So you could do the birds and the bees.
Birds and the bees, yeah.
there you go, Nina. That's what I had in the back of my mind. They need someplace to land. They can't land in the water.
Yeah, and honeybee colonies, on some of those hot summer days, they're going to be drinking upwards of a gallon of water or so. There's, 60 to 80,000 honeybees in a single colony. And so their water needs are pretty significant. And those foragers do a lot of work to bring enough water back to the colony.
Yeah, I would guess. Lisa in Madison sent us an email and wants us to cover colony collapse. She heard that it was worse this year. Emily, you want to start?
This year, Wisconsin, we've definitely seen a large amount of colonies kind of losing their big numbers. And from what I understand of it, we don't really have an exact, researchers don't have an exact kind of reason. It just kind of happened. And I think, Drew, you might have a little more firsthand experience with that.
Well, unfortunately, yeah, I do.
No.
You know, it's a cyclical thing. You know, as Emily said, there's things that get pointed to, but we don't really have a good reason as to why one year it may be bad versus another year. You know, we really saw, obviously, colony collapse disorder rear its head in the early 2000s. And since then, it's ebbed and flowed, and we've had really good years, and we've had really bad years. The reports I'm hearing out of California this year is that the quality of colony health is significantly below what they're hoping for, mm-hmm. what they would usually demand of pollinators going into the orchards. You know, they're basically accepting half-strength colonies in order to make sure that they have enough pollinators on different crops. But, you know, certainly we look at land use, chemical use, air and water quality issues. But there's just a whole host of new diseases that are continually kind of cropping up and showing that, you know, we need to focus on making sure that pollinators are healthy to keep us healthy, keep our food healthy. So,
Drew, you place your bees in somewhat urban areas pretty often. Mm-hmm. What's your reasoning on that?
Yeah, it's interesting. So, getting back to kind of the roots of why my wife and then initially I got into beekeeping, it was on campus at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. And so we actually started with urban beekeeping, and that kind of spurred our interest in looking at, you know, a community like Eau Claire that has a lot to offer. You know, we're a very green city. We're not large by any stretch of the imagination, but there's a lot of kind of urban agricultural activities happening inside of our borders. And there was some promising, be it often anecdotal information, that was showing that bees fared better in a lot of circumstances being in urban environments than some rural environments. And so we kind of, you know, we see, like colony collapse disorder, some years our urban bees do way better, some years our rural bees do way better. It's kind of a way of us to hedge our bets. You know, the nice thing about being small and being diffuse in our area is that we may see one location that doesn't do great, but most of our locations will do.
Yeah. And there's got to be, I was going to say there's got to be a difference in flavor, but maybe not as much. But there,
it's stark. You know, I think that one of my favorite things is giving people a taste of honey from June, honey from July, honey from August and September from one location, and having them be blown away at the variety and the difference between them. You know, most things that honeybees are interested in foraging off of are really only in bloom for a few weeks. And so you kind of let the bees do their own blending and make different little concoctions of nectar that you can then offer to people to try the difference of what our area has to offer. So even a few miles difference and a few weeks difference can offer radically different honeys.
And so you need to be a little able to kind of go with the flow, so to speak. So, and how you market or how you talk about the various honeys that you have to sell.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the nature of what I do is very educational, very hands-on. It's definitely the sort of thing where it's not, it's not immediately apparent to people to look at a jar of our honey on the shelf and understand exactly what they're going to get out of it. I would say that most people are fairly familiar with that kind of golden colored honey bear that sits on the shelf. Most of the honey that we get is probably clover honey or and when I say we, most of the honey that people are familiar with from a grocery store perspective tends to be clover honey and some mix of wildflower or other familiar flowers. And so the honey at grocery stores tends to be blended to a fairly average flavor profile so that people can expect that they're getting the same thing off of the shelf every time.
Our guest today, Emily Cito, the 2025 Wisconsin Honey Queen, and Drew Kaiser, partner in Kaiserson Bee Company of Eau Claire. Questions for them, give a call. I see we have lots of emails. You can, and if you want to add to those, go to talk@wpr.org or give us a call. Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here talking honey and beekeeping today with our two guests, Honey Queen for Wisconsin in 2025, Emily Cito, and Drew Kaiser with us as well. He's a partner in Kaiserson Bee Company out of Eau Claire. So great to have both of them with us today. And you can join in. We had someone wondering if you, and I think that this goes to you, Drew, did you say black honey?
Yeah. Yeah. You can have some honey that is, you know, almost as dark and opaque as molasses. I think the one that probably comes to mind for most people would be buckwheat honey. But we get some late season honeys. I come to understand that sumac honey can be a darker one. And up around here, the last few seasons, I've been getting honey off of... knotweed, Japanese knotweed, which is, you know, highly invasive plant.
Yeah.
Fairly noxious, but makes a honey that is kind of, it's brambly. You know, it tastes like chocolate-covered raspberries or something.
Chocolate-covered raspberries, that'd be pretty good.
It's amazing. I mean, we can't keep it, you know, more than a month or so.
And it's gone.
Not that I'm not going to go out and plant Japanese knotweed. Don't worry.
Oh man, Emily, the flavors. Do you use a broad range of them when you're doing your cooking and demonstrations?
I definitely do. Like Drew mentioned, kind of our clover honey or wildflower is very common, very light. Tend to use it in salad dressings or mixing it in with your coffee and tea. And then just recently, I was donated some locusts. Honey, which is pretty rare to get from what I've heard. And so I'm super excited to start using that. And I mean, really, the honey you can even use in meat dressings or kind of marinating stuff like that. The flavors are just really, really diverse. And we have 30 different flavor or varieties in Wisconsin and then 300 in the U.S. and 3,000 worldwide.
That's a lot of varieties, for sure. And so you're telling me that the honey can be used in your mind for certain desserts come to mind right away, but also salads, main courses.
It really can
appetizers.
Be anything. It's so versatile, and you can also get creamed honeys. So I love putting that on my bagels. I have a cinnamon creamed honey, and it's phenomenal.
Yeah, I know Gentle Breeze makes that too, and I love to put that on bagels as well. Have you done any of that yet, Drew? The cream kind of honey? Like it looks like white butter almost, you know?
Yeah, it's wonderful. I have not at the moment, but it is kind of in my scopes for the future. It's a wonderful product. To build on what Emily was saying, you know, and kind of your question, Larry, I think honey works as a really lovely complement and contrast to a lot of different. So I look at sour foods, I look at bitter foods, I look at salty foods, fatty foods, you know. Gosh, I can't put enough on pizza at this point. Think about a slice of pepperoni pizza with a drizzle of honey. It's a perfect combination of sweet and salty and fatty. We've got a pizza place in Eau Claire that uses it on one of their pies, and it's a favorite of everyone.
You know, I've got a daughter coming to visit me in a couple of days, and she likes pizza. I'm going to try that. I've never had it on pizza. Had it practically every other way, but never on pizza. You just drizzle it on or what?
Yeah. I was in Colorado a few years ago, and they were claiming the mantle that it was Colorado style pizza, I guess. But I think we can take the claim for it here in Wisconsin.
Ann in Eau Claire has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Ann.
Hi, we are big Kaiser Sun Honey fans, so glad to hear both your guests. But wondering if you can solve an argument between my husband and I. I insist that we need to use a wood implement to serve our honey and spread it. And he doesn't believe that it actually affects any of the qualities of the honey to use a metal implement. So would love to hear from our experts what they think.
Well, you know, the implements are always wooden that I've ever seen, Drew or Emily.
I hate to get in the middle of a marital argument. I don't. Would you like to take this, Emily, or would you like me to?
Go ahead, Emily. You start, and then Drew can chime in.
You know, I personally have always used wooden. It feels the right of way as for what I was always told what to do. And I do think it does matter. But I think, Drew, you might be able to speak a little more on the logistics and science behind it.
Yeah, and the wooden ones are usually, they look kind of like almost a corkscrew or something, and you kind of roll it in, and I think it's easier.
A honey dipper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But, so this has been coming around a lot. I know there were some social media images that were saying that metal was potentially destructive to honey. And so I think that there's some truth and some untruths in that particular conversation. So first and foremost, I'll say that almost every piece of equipment that beekeepers are going to use is made out of metal. The extractor, the tools, the uncapping knife, you know, there's a significant amount of stainless steel in the process of harvesting your honey. So where I think that conversation is coming from is the fact that honey is a lightly acidic solution, which means that it's going to be reactive with certain types of metals. So I would say you absolutely never want to store a spoon in your honey, because long-term contact with an acidic substance like honey could lead to some metallic taste coming into the honey. But something as simple as serving honey with a spoon, I don't think is going to make a tremendous difference. You know, the amount of, you're going to lick that off before it's going to cause any sort of problems. The other aspect of things is that, you know, there's kind of an older take to it. Most silverware nowadays is likely stainless steel and is a low reactivity metal. If you're talking about truly silverware, I would probably avoid using that. There's a higher amount of reactivity with silver. So a little bit, both of you are correct. I think use the implement that makes you most happy, and I don't think that it's going to cause too much of a difference.
And I'm with you, Ann. I'd use the wood. Tell him Larry said he always uses the wood. Thanks for calling. Glenn in Eau Claire, what's on your mind?
Hi. Some years ago, I took a beekeeping course with Bend County Beekeepers, and it was surprising to me to learn how much sugar was required to overwinter the bees. So my question is, what is the ratio of sugar fed during the winter compared to the honey produced in the honey season?
So now you're not pouring a bunch of sugar granulated sugar into those hives. Are you, Drew?
That's generally not the process. I mean, so Glenn is absolutely correct. You know, in northern climates, it takes a tremendous amount of food to get honeybees through winter. You know, when you look at a lot of the bigger commercial beekeepers, they're going to put their hives on the back of a truck, and they're going to take them to California, Texas, Georgia, Florida. They're going to take them to warm environments where they don't have to deal with what we Wisconsinites have to deal with in winter. But there are plenty of beekeepers that do keep them here. And generally speaking, I think the University of Minnesota Bee Lab is kind of the experts in northern climate beekeeping. And they tend to say that you want 75 to 100 pounds of honey on a bee colony in order to get them successfully through winter.
And when you're talking about a colony, you're talking about one of those boxes that you see out in the field or whatever.
Well, so, you know, just a little bit of vocab. It's colloquially, we'll call a colony or a hive kind of the same thing, but the hive is the package that the organisms are in. The mm-hmm. colony is the collection of organisms. So the colony is actually the queen, the workers, and the drones that live inside of a hive. But we kind of, you know, there's one colony in one hive, generally speaking, so we use them interchangeably.
Okay.
But, you know, so 75 to 100 pounds of honey is a significant amount. And beekeeping is an expensive activity. So a lot of beekeepers will over-harvest from a colony the honey that they've produced and then supplement with beet sugar or white granulated sugar in order to get them up to the appropriate amount of feed for all of winter time. Honestly, I've been noticing that the winter die-off from the last several years, they don't touch most of the food that they have stored. The issue is largely never starvation for bees around here. I shouldn't say never, but it's more likely that it's going to be some combination of pests. So a Varroa destructor mite is kind of the number one pest that we look at. And when you have an infestation of mites, you almost always then have any combination of viral, bacterial, and then also fungal issues that start to weaken and make the colonies less likely to survive through winter.
Thanks very much, Glenn, for your question and comments. And so that sugar, it's in a kind of a syrup form and poured into what do you do?
Yeah. You'll make so there's light syrup and there's heavy syrup. Going into winter, we'll feed a heavy syrup. So it's about a weight ratio between water and white sugar. So moving in the fall, you'll feed them 1-to-1. One part water to one part sugar. In the springtime, you actually want a lighter syrup, something that's offering them some extra water going into the colony. So you'll do a 2-to-1 syrup at that point. So, you know, on a colony, it's not unrealistic throughout the course of the year to supplement, you know, maybe 10, 15, 20 pounds of white sugar. You only do that during times of the year when the bees aren't bringing in honey, and only into parts of the colony that you would not be harvesting honey from. You know, there's a real adulteration problem, unfortunately, with imported honeys specifically. Mm. But, you know, we want to make sure that the honey that we're gathering into the super boxes of the colony are just nectar, botanically derived sources.
We lots of callers online and plenty of emails too. Ellie emailed us. How much does it cost to get started as a backyard honey producer? Any ideas on that, Emily?
Ideally, first you want to start with your beekeeping courses, and depending on those can fluctuate in how much it costs to attend. And I know there's lots of beekeepers in Wisconsin who do those courses, and it's they're so phenomenal with it. But equipment and hive boxes, you really could look around $1,000 to $2,000, just really getting started. But yeah. every beekeeper is different, and I feel like it comes down to kind of your preference with equipment and tools.
And you were nodding in agreement there, Drew, I think.
Yeah, well, and you hit the nail on the head. It's all about a preference. There's a lot of beekeepers who have a great wood shop and access to lots of pine boards. So, I mean, nothing in the woodenware of beekeeping is tremendously difficult to make on your own. So if you're willing to do it yourself, you can certainly pay less to get the equipment necessary. If you want to buy it all kind of ready to go out of a box, it's going to cost a lot more. So there's a pretty significant sliding scale. Just to add a couple extra, you know, so you've got your woodenware. So there's boxes, and inside those boxes, there are frames. And I should say that's one particular style of colony. There are frameless styles where there's just a top bar that the bees can build wax onto. You've got tools, you've got suits, you've got smokers, you know, like any hobby. I would say if you're talking about getting started in your backyard, you're likely talking about a hobby scale initially, and hopefully you get some honey enough to sell. But you want to go into it with a measured amount of expectation that the first year you might not get a harvest. Successive years after the comb has been built out by your colony in there, it's much more likely that you're going to be able to keep some of the honey that they produce. But it is kind of a, you know, it's a never-ending pit of money that you can spend money on.
Yeah, I'm sure it can be. Oh, man. Bob in Madison has a question, I believe.
Hey, thanks, Bob. Larry. Very timely in light of some of the recent media reports that we've been seeing about honeybees that are used in agricultural pollination and the potential losses among those hives. I'm wondering, would you expect that to be reflected in our Wisconsin honeybees, or is this a separate issue? And also, what can the rest of us do to, or not do, to help honeybees?
Okay, well, let's turn to Emily first, and then we'll get Drew to chime in. Hi, go ahead, Emily.
I can touch on the second half and let Drew kind of touch on that first part of it. He just has more experience with that, and I think he'd be able to share a better perspective. But right now, the DNR just recently released a webpage of shops around Wisconsin that you can get your native flowers and plants from. And so really creating a diverse habitat for the honeybees is just so vital in making sure that they have enough resources to go and pollinate and get their nectar and pollen and just kind of all that from. And basically, one out of every three bites of food we take is due to pollination, and 80% of that is our honeybees. So really making sure that we have those sources for them to pollinate and their habitat, it really plays such a big role in Wisconsin agriculture.
Yeah. Drew, comment?
Mm-hmm. Oh, 100% agree. You know, in terms of what people can do in their own yards or area, is to make sure there's always something in bloom. Try and minimize the amount of chemicals that you put out into the environment, and certainly just be conscientious of what sort of practices you're using. In terms of Bob's first part of the question, I think there's no doubt it's going to have an impact on Wisconsin honeybee population to some extent. You know, the folks who are doing agricultural pollination are doing that across the country. You know, there's very few large-scale beekeepers that would keep their colonies just in Wisconsin and insulate themselves from what's been happening in California and other parts of the country this winter. And honeybees are a highly social creature. And so because we've set up our agricultural system to move the populations around and concentrate them during different parts of the year, we certainly see some spread of disease that takes place because of that. But it's not necessarily doom and gloom. The great thing about honeybees as a commercial pollinator is that their life cycle is short enough that we can manage them. You know, we're able to take colonies that have some vigor, and we can turn one into multiple. And so commercial beekeepers have been doing this for a long time. And I think that you know, in terms of meeting our needs for pollination, I'm not particularly concerned about that. But I do think that you'll see some effect at some point from the losses we've seen.
Bob, thanks again. Let's go to another Bob in Manitowoc County. Bob, hi.
Hi, Larry. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, thank you for the subject matter. I'm a first-year beekeeper, and I really appreciate the insight that Drew and Emily are sharing. My first question is for Drew. Hey, Drew, in your hives, what do you use as a moisture absorber during the wintertime?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's a couple of different routes that I go. Depending upon what sort of food reserves you have in your colony, a good defense towards moisture and starvation is a candy board. So creating basically a shim box that can sit on top of your colony with a hardened block of sugar. In times of need, it's going to be there for them if they're running low on their honey supplies and need to tap into it as they breed. So, you know, honeybees are alive through all of winter, and there's respiration creating moisture. And so one of the big killers of honeybees, as Bob alluded to, is moisture in the winter time. You know, we get these fairly significant swings in temperature that happen from day to night. And so then we get condensation that happens on the lid of our colonies and rains down and will basically drown or chill out the bees because there's too much moisture. So the benefit of a candy board is that turns into foodstuffs that they can readily access and use in a timely fashion. I'll also use, there's a fiber board. This is what University of Minnesota often recommends using. It's a construction grade fiber board. You can find it at most home improvement stores. Oftentimes it's going to have kind of a waterproofing coating on one side and an absorptive side on the other side. They come in 4x8 sheets that you'd have to cut down to fit on top of your colony, but those tend to work really great, at least for a season or two. They're soft enough that bees can potentially start to chew through them, and they certainly will hold a lot of moisture. So I've found some seasons coming out of winter that they might get a little moldy, and I just chuck them. I've heard of people who will use kind of like a quilt box. So basically a full box that's then been filled with either wool. Some people will use dry leaf matter, wood shavings. The great thing and the hard thing about beekeeping is that there are a lot of different methods to accomplish all of the same things. So there's a lot of room for experimentation to see what works for you. And unfortunately, what works for you one year might not work for you the next year, because winter is kind of a target for us.
Yeah. So there you go, Bob. Thank you so much for calling. Talking honey and beekeeping today with Emily Cito, who is the 2025 Wisconsin Honey Queen, and Drew Kaiser, a partner in Kaiserson Bee Company of Eau Claire. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here as we talk honey and beekeeping with Emily Cito and Drew Kaiser. They're doing a great job here. And lots of people online and on the phone, and we'll get to them in just a second. But one thing I haven't mentioned yet, and I want to be sure to do it before the end of the show, is the Chippewa Valley Bee Expo, which is coming up April 12th. Emily, start with you. What could people see and learn? And you're both going to be there. You're nodding yes. Yeah. So what can people see there, Emily?
Each expo I go to is different. So at the Fond du Lac Ag Showcase, you could catch me handing out cheese samples. And for the other half of the day, I was kind of promoting honey and standing with some other Wisconsin honey producers who are selling their honey here at different shows. And so you'll probably catch me walking around, hanging out, chatting with some of the beekeepers, and just really there to answer any questions, talk, take pictures. I'm there.
And Drew, there are several educational opportunities and some fun too.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of great presentations set up for the day, as well as demonstrations. I'll be giving kind of the what you need to know to get started presentation over the lunch hour. But I know we've got some conversations about mites and wintering bees, cooking with honey. There's a lot of different folks. There's over 40 vendors. There's going to be youth activities and food trucks, planting for pollinators, you know, sustainable living. There's a lot of different resources and chances to kind of find a way to be involved with honeybees and beekeeping.
Yeah, it sounds great. And it's at the Northern Wisconsin State Fairgrounds, which I've been to, done some shows up there. And it's a good place because there's lots of parking. There's lots of, you know, you don't have to worry about that stuff.
If you want to find more information, too, you can go to bee-expo.org, and there's information and tickets available there as well.
bee-expo.org. There we go.
Okay.
And it's, again, the date is April 12th.
And coming that's up quick.
And that's no April Fool's joke either. It is April, and runs all day, doesn't it?
It'll be from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m.
9 to 4. There we go. Jerry in Verona, your turn now. Thanks for joining in.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have a good friend who's a master gardener, and she's real kind of into indigenous plants and insects and that sort of thing. And she read something that there might be an issue that a lot of beekeepers use European bees, which could be maybe considered like an invasive species. Is there anything to that?
Well, Emily, we start with you and then let Drew chime in.
So beekeepers use a whole different variety of species. So there are your European bees, even Italian, Russian. You can get some mixes in there as well. And they all bring different qualities to beekeeping, whether they are better in the winter, produce more honey, more docile. It really, you can use so many different varieties. And they are technically invasive to the U.S., but they're just recently there's been some scientific discovery of what we presume to be the European honeybee that was found quite a few years ago here in the U.S. So it's really kind of a toss-up.
Drew, what do you think?
Yeah, I wouldn't go so far as to say invasive. There's a fairly technical definition to that implies that they're persistent and problematic. They're non-native for sure. So my Latin isn't super great, but as Emily was alluding to, we use Apis mellifera or Apis mellifera, the honey-bearing bee, which is often referred to as the Western or the European honeybee. And so when she was talking about Italians or Russians, those are subspecies of the same genus species, Apis mellifera. It's not necessarily that they are bad, but what makes them good at being agricultural pollinators also makes them potentially problematic in terms of how they can compete for resources in an area. And so what they're great for is being able to go to a place like Central Valley, California, where there's nothing but almond orchards and no sustainable forage for native bees to persist throughout the year and to pollinate crops that require insect pollination. In terms of being in an area where there is diverse forage and there is native populations, I think it's fairly incumbent upon beekeepers to be responsible about not overpopulating an area with honeybees, because those 60 to 80,000 honeybees in a colony can go out and rob nectar from flowers that could otherwise be beneficial to some of the native bees. You know, in Wisconsin, we have something like 300 or so native species. Most of the bees that we would see are going to be bumblebee species. Different genus. The Bombus genus is the bumblebee species. There's 12 or 15 bumblebees that are endemic to Wisconsin. And then a lot of the vast majority of native bee species are actually solitary stingless bees that most people aren't going to really see in their day-to-day lives, because as the name implies, there's a solitary situation in which they lay their eggs. And so you see very few of them, few and far between.
Nina in Menasha, your turn. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is a fantastic, it's just a fascinating, bees are wonderful. But, and thank you for the show. I just read something, I'm very ignorant on beekeeping, but I like to learn. And I just want, I read an article that blew my mind, is I assumed bees, you know, are pollinating everything and liked all flowers. But those of you who are planting a garden or, you know, planning shrubbery or landscaping, look up plants or flowers that bees do not like or can't or do not pollinate. I didn't even know that was a thing.
It is indeed, and it comes up a lot. And I know that some of the organizations, like the beekeeper organizations, are interested in native plants as, you know, for flower-type situations, Drew.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was Jerry that mentioned his friend, the Master Gardener. Most Master Gardener organizations maintain pretty good lists of different pollinator-friendly plants that you can get in each area. I think focusing on native plants is a really good way of being able to kind of bridge the divide between those native pollinators that need support and honeybees. You know, when we talk about, you hear a lot of folks say things like save the bees. And as much as I got into beekeeping initially because I heard about colony collapse disorder, I felt a need to do something in this sphere. The bees that really need our saving are those native bees, you know, the ones that are a little less often seen, but do a really important job in our ecosystem. You know, we're home to the rusty patch bumblebee, which was actually the first bee species to be listed as critically endangered. We've seen them in Eau Claire in the last few years, but we certainly don't see them as often as we used to. And so by planting native plants, we hopefully give some of those species a fighting chance to be able to persist on and play the role they need to play.
Richard emailed us, should you store your honey in a glass bottle rather than plastic? Emily?
That's an interesting question. With honey shows, you know, you always have to have them in the glass bottles for judging, and you got to be weary about your fingerprints and the lids and the bubbles. But I don't know, Drew, do you prefer glass or honey, or what's your take on that?
You know, I prefer glass myself for a number of reasons, but I don't think there's a significant disadvantage to storing honey in glass on face, I guess I should say. The disadvantage to storing honey in plastic is it's harder to reliquify if you want to, you know. So yeah, Raw honey is going to crystallize and become solid, which I and a lot of people enjoy eating, but a lot of people want their honey to be fluid, and being in plastic doesn't really offer you a good chance to do that without potentially melting the jar. So glass is a great option that way.
And on that note, I'm so sorry. We've got lots of callers online, and we've got lots of emails that we haven't gotten to, but it means that we'll have to do this again. So I want to thank you.
You'll have to come to the Chippewa Valley Bee Expo.
That would be fun. April 12th is the Chippewa Valley Bee Expo, and our guests have been Emily Cito, our Wisconsin Honey Queen for 2025, and Drew Kaiser, partner in Kaiserson Bee Company of Eau Claire. Thank you both very much, and thank you so much for listening. And hey, stay with us. We're talking honey. Next, we're going to talk about wine. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.